Good evening, everyone. January 1st, 2024, good way to bring in the new year. Sorry I wasn't here last week. I can pretty much guarantee, Mitzvah Hashem, that the next 4 weeks I will be here. I'm on sabbatical this semester, so we could have some times where I miss a week, but we'll try to keep it going. I don't like missing any weeks. The first thing I want to say is that Rabbi Kelman's not here. He last minute went to Israel. He'll be back on Sunday, so I'm running everything. And tonight's class is sponsored by Carla and Jules Zulzbach in observance of the Yahrzeit on the 12th of Tevet of Jules' father, Mr. Jacob Zulzbach, Rabbi Yaakov ben Achaver, Rabbi Yitzchak Zal. We've spoken about in the past what the word Chaver means in a for a German Jew Orthodoxy. And maybe, we, as Rabbi Kama said, an email that went out, maybe I'll be blessed with good health and Neshama Shel Aven Aliyah. And thank you very much for the Zulzbachs for that. A few things, or more than a few things, before we begin. I listened to the class, and I mentioned Rabbi Nobel. I think I said Nobel, but it must be Nobel. That was pronounced just like Nobel Prize. And I thought that he was the teacher of Rosenzweig. And yes, I looked it up. Well, I don't know in terms of teacher, but he influenced Rosenzweig, Buber, many others. Last Saturday night, Motzei Shabbos in Boca. I see the Zulzbachs. Yes. Hi. Take it away.
I would like to add something.
Please.
There is a kind of a special bond between the Sulzbach family and Rav Zedek Bamberger, my great grandfather, Professor Abraham Sulzbach, was a Yosef, an orphan at the age of 14. And he was taken in by Rav Bamberger in his house in Würzburg. He came from Hamburg in order to be able to go to yeshiva there.
Oh, very interesting. And I'm glad I wasn't sure if the name was pronounced like with a Z, Zulzbach or Sulzbach. So now I hear it's like an S. Okay. Very nice. Thank you. And thank you very much for the sponsorship and your continuing comments. Last Saturday night, I was in Boca in the supermarket, and one of our listeners, Mike, recognized me actually walking down the aisle of the supermarket. So I thank you, Mike. And he also made a correction. So he caught it. That was before I listened to the class, but no one else seemed to have caught it. But I did say, I said that Mendelssohn was a student of Shimshon Morpurgo, the author of the Shemeshut Tzedakah, which of course is incorrect. Thank you, Mike. I misspoke. First of all, Mendelssohn was a student of Rav David Frankel, the Karban HaEda on the Yerushalmi. But I didn't mean to. What I meant to say was that Spinoza was a student, and the Rebbe put it in Cheirim. But that was a double misspeak because it's not Shimshon Morpurgo, it's Saul Mortera. So all these names are getting confused in my mind. Incidentally, in terms of names, we'll get somewhere today. You'll hear those of you who signed up already to the Central Europe trip. You'll hear lots of names, but I want to remind those who don't get the Torah in Motion emails. We sent it out. There's a huge discount for those who sign up by January 9th, and if not that, by January 30th. So Mirtz Hashem, we'll be back in Central Europe this summer. Okay, there's two things I want to do before I get to the regular class. We have important things we have today, and I think one more class dealing just with secession, and we'll come back for a couple more classes on Bamberger. I was asked to do classes on by someone I think I see on the screen now on the Langer case, so I'm going to do the Langer case also. Wow, that's actually an excellent idea. I have material that other people don't have as well, so we'll do that. The two things I want to focus on is still maybe one more class on issues dealing with Avegos. You know, we never really study Avegos, at least I never did. I only learned it with some of you might know Rabbi Eric Levy, either from Atlanta or from Toronto. When he was living in my town, studying for Smicha for the Rabbanut, you need to know Avegos. So I learned a number of Simonim and Shulchan Aruch with him, but I never really went into it. And in yeshiva, other than if you're a student of the Rav, I guess you didn't study it. But the two things I want to deal with is that and the name Bear, because a lot of comments on the name Bear. But let me first, a number of people, Ben and I don't want to leave anyone out, but a number of you emailed that the general practice is, it might be unanimous practice. I'll show you what Ramosha says later, that if you bring the mace to the, let's say, the airport to get on an airplane to go be buried in Eretz Yisrael, then as soon as you finish with that, you start, you are an Avel right then. That's the first thing. The second thing is that Ben points out that when his parents were brought to Israel for burial, his Rav, both his synagogue Rav and his personal Rav, ruled that he was not an Onin from the time of death to burial because he's in America and he's in Israel and it was be handled by other people. He also sent me Rav Rimon. If you don't know who Rav Rimon is, look it up. He's becoming quickly becoming a leading posek in the religious Zionist world. I mean, he already is a religious posek, but I mean, even outside of circles in Israel. In fact, a few weeks ago, we had a Shabbaton at my shul from the Kollel. We have a Kollel from Passaic, like a Haredi Kollel, and the person who's in charge of it, he gave the Dvar Torah Shabbos morning, and lo and behold, who does he quote from? Rav Rimon. So you have a little bit of a crossover there. But he sends me from one of Rav Rimon's sforim that he says if the funeral is delayed, the aninus goes as long as the relatives are involved in preparing the something with the burial. But if they have nothing to do with it anymore, or there's no need, so for example, if the death is in Chutz La'aretz and they're waiting for the person to be brought to Eretz Yisrael. Or they're waiting for people to come from Chutz La'aretz and there's nothing more to do. They've already given the body over, or the government doesn't allow it for some reason. There is no aninus during that period. I don't know if that's what everyone does, but because you still have the issue of kavod ha'meis. What about kavod ha'meis? But that's what Rav Rimon says. And Ben actually wrote a little piece on what he calls being a halachic nothing, because you're not an avel during this period, and that was his circumstance. You're not an Avel because you haven't had the burial yet, and you're not an Onin. So it's a strange situation to be in. Ezra says the same thing as well. But I want to read you something. So I was in is in Florida, and there's a sefer I saw there, which Anotzar Chachma, you don't have this volume. Only have two. This is the third volume. It's called Pitrei or Pisrei Tshuvos. It's a play on Piskei Tshuva. If you look in volume three, it goes by the order of Shulchan Aruch. Listen to this. If you want to get straightforward rules as to how to conduct yourself, let me just read it to you in Hebrew. And this dealt with the issue my wife was involved in, Erev Shabbos. Inasa onen be'erev Shabbos. If you're an onen Erev Shabbos, ba'ofen shelo yikavrehu rak achar Shabbos, you're not going to bury the person until after Shabbos. That was the case we were in. Lo chalav aninus mincha. So there's no aninus at all because you're not involved at all anymore. You have nothing to do with it. That's what he says first. But then look what he says after that. But there are those who say you are an onen and you do have mincha. So what is it? He says, either you're not or you are. And that's the issue with a lot of these halachas I've learned, is that there's no one uniform view on it. Let me read you, give you a couple of other things he says. Okay, so the Shulchan Aruch says, this is in Shin Ayin Hey, if you take the mace and you're sending the mace to a separate place, that would be the equivalent of like we go to the airport. But Shulchan Aruch is speaking about, let's say you put it on a carriage and it's being brought to another city. When you come on my Central Europe trip, you'll see Rav Mordechai Bennett. Rav Mordechai Bennett was the great Rav of Nicholsburg, but he didn't die in Nicholsburg. He died somewhere else. And he was buried somewhere else. So how does he end up in Nicholsburg? Wait till you hear the story. For those who don't come, I'll tell you, remind me, Mirza Hashem, after the summer. I'll tell you the story. Yeah, it's an amazing story. Okay, so what do you do? As soon as you turn away, then you turn away from, you give the body over, you turn away to go back, you start your aveilus. So that's the basis for the halacha that everyone's emailing me, that when you bring the mace to the airport, and then you leave it there. Then you begin your aveus. But listen to the lashon of the Shulchan Aruch. He says, hold on. Misha darkan lishloach ames lemedina acheres lekavro ve'einam yodim matay yikaber. In other words, you bring the mace to the carriage and you send it away, and you don't know when the funeral is going to be. Because, you bring it there, you don't know when it's going to be. It could be today, it could be tomorrow, you're not sure. Then you're supposed to start maschilin limnos shiva immediately, as soon as you turn your head. Okay, what's this? Today we're in a different circumstance, right? People are on the Zoom, they're on the telephone, they know exactly when the kavura is. So if I bring it today and it's going to arrive in Eretz Yisrael tomorrow, I know the kavura is tomorrow. The implication of this would seem to be that you don't start the avelos until the next day, and you're an onan. So, well, how could you be an onan? You have nothing to do with the mace. Well, as we'll see, Rabbi Greenwald says, if you adopt this logic, he says that in America, no one is an onan. Because today in America, we don't have the mace in the house. We give it over to the funeral parlor and they take care of everything. So Rabbi Greenwald says, based on this, in America, no one has aninus. But he says that's not the halacha, because there's also according to Rabbeinu Tam, that would be the halacha. Rabbeinu Tam, it's described that when his sister died, because he had nothing to do with it, didn't practice aninus. Rabbi Greenwald says, we assume that there's an issue of kavod hames, so there is onei. Okay, so that's what you have in the Pisrei Tshuvos. Then he raises the question. What about, he says, in today's day and age, when you bury someone in a different city, how do they know exactly when the kavura is going to be? How do they telephone? So the question is, do we say that the avelos starts from when you turned away? Oh, mamash. So when are you supposed to start it? And again, what does he say? He says, Rov ha'achronim hold the chal aveilus miyat. So then, but if you look in the notes, so here, this is a machlokas also. And then he says, however, and he reads this as the halacha, im ha'gadol mishpacha ho'echem ames. If the head of the mishpacha actually goes to Eretz Yisrael with the mace, then nishar sham b'kom kvura, and he's there when they do the kvura. He says that everyone else who remains in America, they don't start. If you know when it's going to be, they're watching on Zoom. They don't start their avelos until the actual burial. And he cites the sources, including Rav Yashif, who says this. So fascinating. But again, fascinating that we don't have black letter law on something like this. And then he says, he talks about what happens when you find out, if you're not in the city, and you find out that it happened. Hold on. Oh, he tries to say, okay, so if you are in a different city and you hear about the death and you can't go to the funeral, he says avelos begins immediately when you hear about it. However, but that's not the case if you're actually taking the body and are still involved with it. Okay, so that's I don't need to read anything more from Pisrei Tshuvos, but let me read you from what Rabbi Greenwald says. This is the classic book, right? Kobo Avelos. All the rabbis use this book. And I don't need to repeat the things we've already seen. I told you about it, but I just want to tell you, to give you another example of how, I don't know how the pulpit rabbi in the 50s and 60s, when this is their book, what they're supposed to do, if this is how Rabbi Greenwald explains matters. On page 269, he says as follows. If you got a telegram, you received a telegram that your korov had died in a different place and you can't go to the funeral, when are you supposed to begin to be an aval? What does he say? The Netziv holds that you're an oneg until the kavura. That is, you get a telegram and they tell you the funeral's tomorrow. You're not going to be there. You're an oneg. But his son-in-law, Rafal Shapiro is the father-in-law of Rav Chaim Brisker, and also the Maharsham, they said you begin avelos immediately. So what are you supposed to do? You're a rabbi here. You get this question. The guy gets a telegram, figure like the 1960s or 50s. You open up your Kobo Avelos and he tells you the Netziv says one thing, and Rafal Shapiro and the Maharsham says the opposite. How are you supposed to decide something like that? I don't know how you're supposed to decide something like that. I guess whatever you do, you're right. Whatever you do, you're wrong. I don't know what to tell you. I can say that Rav Moshe, in Iros Moshe, Yoredeya number 170, he has the Shaila about Mesim, Shemolichin Eretz Yisrael, V'habonim Kan, when do you start Avelos? And Rav Moshe holds, despite the Lashon of the Shulchan Aruch, that you might imply, and some people do, that if you know when the burial is, then you're an onan until that. Rav Moshe argues against that, and he says that everyone, you start avelos as soon as you give the body up. And finally, and thank you for Elazar for this. He sent me Rabbi Felder's tshuvot, not tshuvot, his sefer on avelos. And what does Rav Felder say? Erev Shabbos. If there's no time for burial, there's no aninus. So we saw it's a machlokes, but this is what Felder says, and he says therefore Madlik Neir Shabbos for Yom Tov Bracha, like we concluded, you do make it with a bracha. So fascinating. You know what? I see. I'm going to hold off till next week, only because I see it's already after 8:45. I have all this stuff about the name Bear. Remember, I asked the question: why would anyone, first of all, name their kid Bear? Bear is the word bear. In Yiddish, but in England, it's a dove. It's a bad animal, according to the Gemara. I should bring redemption to the world. I saw that some time ago in a sefer by Rabbi Rakoff. There was a rabbi in London, Yom Tov Lipman Rakoff. His brother was Bezalel Rakoff, the Rav of Gateshead. And in one of his sfarim, I guess I could find it if I need to, but one of his sfarim, he raises that question about there. But the origin of this name and so I have good stuff on that, but I'll leave that till next class. The one other thing I just want to mention is this book, Rav Israel Hildesheimer, the biography from David Ellenson. Why do I mention it? Because David Ellenson, a fascinating individual, here's a picture of him, grew up Orthodox in Virginia. Then he went to Reform movement. He became a rabbi and a scholar and the president of the Hebrew Union College for many years. His area of scholarship was German Orthodoxy, and he wrote this wonderful book, Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer, The Creation of a Modern Jewish Orthodoxy. He deals a lot with the Auschwitz controversy because Hildesheimer was on Hirsch's side during this against Bamberger. But Hildesheimer's Talmud Mufak, Horowitz, takes the Frankfurt Gemeindeschule. And so he discusses this because Hildesheimer tried to dissuade him. But then after he took it, Hildesheimer accepted it. He even has a letter defending him saying, basically the attitude is sometimes your children, they do things that you don't want, but you have to support them. And he even comes to Frankfurt and speaks in the shul and gives a shiur there. But David Ellenson passed away just a couple of weeks ago, and he was a real mensch. He's the, they say, at least I saw in one of the eulogies, he's the only person ever to receive an honorary award from HUC, from JTS, and from YU. So I don't remember when he got it from YU, and I'm a little surprised. That's what it said in the Hesped. If it's not true, please let me know, because I am a little surprised that YU would give an honorary degree to a leader of the Reform movement. I'm not talking about a Reform Jew. They give that all the time. But this is someone active in the Reform movement. But I saw that in one of the write-ups. I know that he spoke. Rabbi Lamb used to convene. How do I know this? I know this because I was invited. I couldn't come once, but Rabbi Lamb, for the smicha students, used to convene like I'm not gonna say secret, but a closed group to hear from scholars, discussion. And I was invited once, but it was too much of a pain for me to go there. They And they couldn't find a good date. But when they were trying to get me to go, the person told me that, David Ellenson came also. And I was a little surprised. And he says, well, we don't advertise it, but I can tell you that he was a mensch, and he will be missed. And I benefited a good deal from his scholarship. Let me get my books here. Okay, we're picking up now with still on the outfit controversy. I think we'll need to today and one more class on it. But today we're getting to a really a, I love that what I'm going to tell you now, the letter, because I think it shows you the genius of Rav Chaim Moshe Grudzinski. Look, there were many Gedolim before the World War II. You know how many great Gedolim there were in Europe, in Eastern Europe? It boggles the mind, the numbers of people who were just outstanding, outstanding. But someone has to rise above, and for a variety of reasons, and I think we're going to see a good example of why this was a good choice. But Rav Chaim Ozer became, at least for the Litvisha, the Lithuanian world, the outstanding Gadol HaDor. He was the head of the Vada Yeshivos, really very much involved in what they called Tzarchei Tzibur, involvement in the community. And he actually penned what I think really one of the most important discussions dealing with the Auschwitz controversy. And like I said, the insightful answer he gives shows his greatness. And while I'm reading it, and I'll return to this again, ask yourself, would the rabbis today have the same approach? I don't think so. What's the background to this? The background is, let me get out my letter here. It's from approximately 1913. We don't have yes, 1913, the letter, Shvat, 1913. The reform movement in Germany had recently issued some new proposals, things that they're going to do. They call the Richtlinien. Now, they're just more anti-halachic instructions of how their clergy is supposed to operate, things of that nature. So one of the individuals in Germany, a sympathizer for the Hirschian position, wrote to Rav Chaim Ozer that now that the reform movement is doing even more bad stuff, maybe it's time to revisit the Bamberger-Hirsch controversy and go in accordance to Hirsch, require that you, Rav Chaim Ozer, should issue psak that everyone has to join the separatist community when there is a separatist community. Remember, at this time in 1913, you had a separatist community in Berlin and Frankfurt, maybe about seven or eight other communities, but the majority community, most Jews in Germany, were members of the large community, the Einheitsgemeinde, the general community, same in Frankfurt. So the question is to him is that maybe it's time to make a change and issue a psak. Until now, it's basically there's been two psakim, one yes, you have to separate, one you don't. So he wants Rav Chaim Moser to issue a psak. This tshuva, which I'm going to summarize for you now, or this letter, appeared in the Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg Memorial Volume. By the way, this reminds me, I want to show you one more thing, because today, just the situation today in Berlin. So if you go, you can, it's in German, but when you go to the site on my screen, the upper right-hand corner, it says you want to translate it. So it translates it from German into English. So here are the synagogues in Berlin now. And as it says, our unified community offers many different rites in eight synagogues: Ashkenazi Orthodox, Sephardi Orthodox, liberal egalitarian, or conservative. And then you have the various shuls over here. And here are the rabbis. So you have the five rabbis. And here are the rabbis. So here, Rabbi Niren. There she is. She's one of the rabbis. She's a member of the general community in Berlin. There's also a separatist community today in Berlin. She's from the Rabbinical Seminary Assembly, JTS. And here's another rabbi. This is Rabbi Zevers. He comes out of the Leo Beck College, which I think some people think of as reform, but he's a real traditionalist. He's definitely not reform. But look who's also in it, Rabbi Ehrenberg. If you go to Berlin and you go to the main show in Berlin, this is the Rav. And also, who's one of the other rabbis? Rabbi Techtal. So you see that Rabbi Ehrenberg and Rabbi Techtal are sitting together in one community with the non-Orthodox rabbis. This was the mainstream approach before the war. This was not the Hirschian approach. So Rav Chaim Ozer has this letter, which I'm just going to summarize for you, and then let's reflect on it. What an amazing letter this is, sir. Okay. He says, I received your letter, and you asked me this complicated question about the Shelas Breda, you know, the Austrit, where the Rav Hagon at Sadiq, Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, said that since the government in 1876 has given permission to separate, he says, so what did Hirsch do? Hora halacha l'maisa shekol b'nei kiyoso mechuyavim apiyadin liparin min hakehila gedola v'gazar isur v'sha'er ba'hala. Hirsch ruled halachically that every Jew, every religious Jew, because that's what he's speaking to, obviously, has to separate from the general community and not pay taxes anymore. And what does Rav Chaim Ozer say? Rov b'nei kehila lo shamulo. That most of his kehila, we're not talking about even the people in the general community, his own kehila, Rav Chaim Ozer is correct, his own followers, most of them did not listen to him. You know, sometimes I think about what was going through his mind here. You know, rabbis never like it when the community doesn't listen to them, but here he gets up, usually it's sort of implicit. You know what the rabbi wants you to do and you don't listen, but here he gives a psak. He publishes it. He demands it. He speaks about it. And he comes to show and he looks out from the pulpit where they give him kavod, but he's looking around and he's seeing all the people in the pulpit who aren't listening to him. And like, what's going through his mind? I mean, he must have saw it as a lack of kavod and all that, but that was the situation. And then he goes on. Oh, and he explains. So why didn't they separate? Because they were able to make an agreement with the larger community. And then he says, Rav Chaim Ozer doesn't have the facts entirely correct. He says they made an agreement with the larger community that they could choose for the Orthodox an Orthodox rabbi, and that the Haredim, the Orthodox would only, when the word Haredi here just means Orthodox, would choose it. And all the Kashrus would be under the control of the Kehila, there'd be Shlita, Mikvah, a school, etc. Rav Chaim Ozer, I'm not sure if he knows the facts completely. The sense you get from this is that the members of Hirsch's community didn't separate because of this agreement, which is true, but there's also a whole group who were never part of Hirsch's community who were also Orthodox. But whatever, he explains all the facts we know. He says the Beis HaCholin, the hospital, will be Tachas Hashgachas HaRav, everything we spoke about, and he'd have a based in. And then he says, and the tax for the community that the Orthodox pay will only go to Orthodox institutions and for the hospital and for the cemetery. And then he says that this money will be actually written. It'll be written down who's from the Orthodox community, and that their tax money doesn't go to anything non-Orthodox. That's, I think, what he's referring to is the compromise we spoke about of Rav Moshe Mainz. But most Orthodox Jews didn't actually fill out any form. I don't even know if Berlin, you could do that, fill out any form. So, because at the end of the day, they were the minority, and it's just that they know their money is going to Orthodox things. Then the Reform money is going to the Reform things. But there, he does mention here that this notion we saw, which some people did take advantage of, that actually was written down that you're an Orthodox Jew, and therefore your money, you know, money's fungible. So I don't know what that means, but you know, at least that they know that your money should not go to the Reform. And then he says that most of the Orthodox, Rov HaYerein, they listen to what the Rav HaGaon HaTzadik, he gives them the same title, Bamberger, said that they don't have to separate. And then he says, next paragraph, but now that we've seen this new changes, the Pokrim, he calls them, you know, the heretics, they're doing more heresies. It's like when the Reform movement in America started ordaining women rabbis, all of a sudden, and they were saying, oh, we have to revisit our relationship with them. We spoke about this a while ago. Remember with the chaplaincy, it was a big problem because now how could the Orthodox be in an organization where they now have women chaplains from the Reform and they didn't want to have any involvement? Remember I raised this? I said, what's the big deal? You know, the Orthodox, then, I mean, the Reform male chaplains were okay. Now the problem is that you have a female chaplain. It's, I mean, now you're going to get upset with it. And Rav Chaim Olzer is going to say these things are meaningless. The heresy has been there from the beginning. But he said, but they asked him this question. They've done more bad things, so maybe now we could say the situation's changed, and it's time to separate. Okay, so Rav Chaim Olzer says to him in the third paragraph. Listen to this. With all my desire to answer you. And to answer you according to halacha, he says it's very difficult for me to solve this problem without getting into the fundamental issue that Hirsch and Bamberger disputed. And he said this question, the machlokes of Hirsch and Bamberger, l'fi da'ati einena k'chol ha'oros isra v'heter. The Gam Shelos Agunos, Hayoser Chamuros, Asher Shorsham Pasuach, Pashasu. He says that this question, separatism or not, is not like all the other halachic matters we see. It's not even like a Aguna question where what do? You go, you open up. He says it's the Shorash of these things are found in Shas and Poskim. And you not want to how to answer it? He says if you want to answer it, you look at the Shitas Rishonim, the Achronim, and he says you decide based on Kolei Ha'ara and you find an answer. You get a shaila, you look in the Shulchan Aruch, you look in the Gemara, you come up with an answer. Lo kein pitaron she'el hazo. He says, this is not the case with this question of separatism. You can't just pick up a Gemara or Shulchan Aruch and find the answer to it. He says, why? He says, it's yesod is found b'hakara gemura uv'hashkafa behira. How are you going to answer this? You know, the essence of this question is found in hashkafa, in how you look at matters, hashkafically. Ladas is a derech ishara. Lidor gedra v'alamo deferetz l'chazek hadas. Which side you view as better in terms of spreading Judaism and stopping the progress of the reform, that's not a halachic matter. That's hashkafic matter. That's an ideological approach. And whichever side you think is correct ideologically, that's going to then determine what you think is better. He says, "Ain't suffic beinai." He says, "There's no doubt in my opinion that the great rabbis, Hirsch and Bamberger, did not dispute when it came to horos v'dinim rock. It was only their hashkafos were different." This is a little—he's not really correct on this, because they did dispute on certain halachic matters. But I would say that the halachic matters were based upon their hashkafa. So maybe that's what Rav Chaim Olzer is saying. There definitely were some halachic disputes, but it all goes back to the hashkafa. And he says, when it comes to hashkafic matters like that, who can know this? Only Hachacham HaMakir Es Makomo Osog Okila. The only way you're going to get a judgment about this matter is if you're living there and you can really see, you understand it up close, intimately. Remember that. That was what the Hirsch said to about Bamberger. You don't live here. You can't understand it. But at least Rav Chaim Olzer is assuming they both live in Germany, so they have an understanding. He says, if you live there, you'll know tachunos anshei hakeila. You'll know the characteristics of the people. You'll be connected to them. You'll understand. You'll know what, and you'll know what's going to happen in the coming generation. In other words, you need to know the Metzias. You need to know it up close. And then he explains, based on this, an amazing thing. He says, therefore, this appears to be the reason why they didn't ask, they had this great dispute between Hirsch and Bamberger. Whenever there was machlokes in Germany, they would always turn to the rabbis of Eastern Europe. You turn to Rabbi Zalchanan Spector, the Netziv, because those were considered the greatest of the rabbanim. The rabbis of Germany were great, but those were either greater, or if you wanted, if there's machlokes in Germany, so you turn to them. Rav Chaim Olzer says, they never turned in this dispute. It would have been made so much sense to then turn to the rabbis of Eastern Europe. He says, these great rabbis were not asked the Hagola. They never turned to these great rabbis. Who does he say? The Malbim, Rishos Salanter, Rav Diskin, Yeshua Diskin, Rav Yitzchak Hanan, as well as the rabbis of Galicia. It's true. Why didn't they turn to the other rabbis? Rav Chaim Moser says. He says because this question is not Einu nifteras al pi mekorim ha'talmudim va'poskim. Today we would say mekorot, but he makes it masculine. He says that this is not a dispute which can be decided from the Talmud and poskim. It's like if you want to know if you can use a tea bag on Shabbos, okay, you can go into Borough Park or New Square and you can ask the posek. If it's a pure halacha question, it doesn't really matter. But if you have a question dealing with like your local modern Orthodox shul, certain things, you can't go to them. You need to ask a rav, a posek who understands the way people live in the more modern communities. It's obvious that's, when you're on a college campus, you have certain questions you need to ask a rabbi who understands that. You can't call up a rabbi of B'nai Brak, ask him. He doesn't understand the whole situation there. That's why when I was working at Brandeis, I would ask Rabbi Ephraim Greenblatt, although he's not a modern Orthodox rabbi. He lived in Memphis for what, by then 40 years. He knew, all the people in Memphis. He knew them. They went to secular schools. I mean, so he had an understanding of what the situation is. So Rabbi Chaim Moser says, you can't ask, they didn't ask the Rabbanim, the Gedolim in Eastern Europe, because they didn't understand the situation. And this was not a halachic question. You just open up you're not asking about a Shabbos elevator or something. This is about the situation, the unique situation of Jews in Germany. This can only be answered, he says, al pisari yashara v'ashkafa nachona me'ira. It has to do with your outlook. And since these people are berichok makom, they're living far away. Lo yochul hisarei. They couldn't involve themselves with it, and they didn't know. They didn't have the outlook, the hashkafa, the understanding of it, l'achriya, and therefore they had to rely on the local rabbis based in Shabbos Makom. It's their job, he says, to make the geder, to decide what's the best path to strengthen Judaism, and he says. That's why you had the dispute, because Rav Hirsch and Rav Bamberger just had different understandings of what's the, they all agreed with the goal to strengthen Judaism. The question is, what's the better path? He says, if this was just the machlokes about hachras hadin, of deciding the halacha, how do you understand a Rambam or a Shulchan Aruch? Why you sholim mitzvah d'or l'achriya b'neihem u'agid hacha brura? Then they would have asked, but it's not such a question. Incidentally, I have to say, though, that two things. Number one, that Hirsch disagrees with where Chaim says. Hirsch sees this as a halachic issue. He doesn't see it as just as something that arises from hashkafa. I think we, looking at it, can say, yes, it does arise from hashkafa to a large extent, and we can maybe speculate why Hirsch felt it was so important to adopt separatism. I've given you some theories in the past about that, but Hirsch would have denied that this is not fundamentally a halachic dispute. Second of all, and this is, I don't know how Rav Chaim Moser didn't see this or didn't get this, but his conclusion, I'll read you two more paragraphs, is that basically I can't decide on this matter. This is a sort of matter that can only be decided by the local rabbanim. I can't decide. He's actually deciding in Bamberger's favor. He didn't see it this way, but he is. Because remember, Rav Bamberger never said you should remain in one community. You have to remain in one community. All he said is that if you choose to, you can. So by Rav Chaim Ozer not answering anything, Sheval Tase, by not being involved, in the end, he is deciding in accordance with Rav Bamberger because he's permitting the people to remain in the community. Because he's saying, I can't decide, so therefore we're going to remain it the way it is. The machlokes remains the way it is. Well, if you say the machlokes remains the way it is, then you're deciding in accordance with Bamberger. Because Bamberger says that they can remain there. It's Hirsch who says they can't remain there. So in a sense, by punting it, he really is, without intending it, he's deciding like Rav Bamberger. He then says, in the last two paragraphs, or last three paragraphs, he says, there's no doubt that Rav Hirsch, he says, Zikas harabim b'masav ha'gedolim. He says Hirsch benefited the German Orthodoxy with his wonderful sermons and his books full of Avos Torah and Yirat Shamayim, and through establishing this wonderful community which is perfect in so many ways. And then he says, it had they not established such a community, Orthodoxy would have just evaporated into the larger community. But now that there's a separate Orthodox community, Altaras HaKodesh, that's a strong community and a successful community, the larger community has to recognize that and give in the ways we've already seen. And then he says, this person who wrote to him thought that he could maybe set this dispute between Bamberger and Hirsch was maybe based on this Gemara in Eruvin 32b. There's a machlokas there. Hirsch, Rabbi Yehuda says it's preferable to a chover that he commit a minor transgression, so that an Am Haaretz will not commit a major transgression. Rav Shimon ben Gamliel holds no. It's preferable to a chaver that an Am Haaretz commit a major transgression, that he not commit even a minor transgression. This is a machlokes. Do we say that it's preferable that, for example, we should allow the community to commit a minor transgression, because through this minor transgression, it's not going to lead to a major transgression? If we announce, for instance, if we try to stop this minor transgression, then the whole community, or lots of the community, I should say, is going to commit a major transgression. Like, let's say lots of members of the community were eating in a certain place that, they were eating a certain item that's of questionable kashrus. Maybe even you could say it's rabbinically forbidden, but if you tell them publicly not to do this, then they're going to start eating mamish midyaraisa tarfus. They're going to eat actual midyaraisa. So he says that that's a machlokas. Some hold that you're supposed to, in such a case, permit a minor transgression, where people don't know any better, really, to prevent a major transgression. Others hold no. Not that I think this is a minor transgression, but I had a case like this, and I think some people would say that I followed the view of a minor transgression. But having met Rabbi Albag, I do not believe this. But I remember the Washington Heights community. I saw something where someone showed me that they said that there was something from Rabbi Ralbag, and on the Washington Heights community said that everyone has to get rid of it completely, whatever. So what am I talking about? I was in Orlando once. I'm in the supermarket, and this guy comes up to me from England. He sees I'm wearing a yarmulke. This is years ago, probably 20 years ago. I took my kids to Disney World, and he wants to know, in the supermarket, is there any kosher meat? He says, I'm talking to him. He says he doesn't keep kosher, but he keeps kosher meat. So he's looking for some kosher meat. So I brought him over and I showed him the Hebrew National. It's America's. Every supermarket, pretty much in America, right? You find some Hebrew National something. So I gave it to that. So he took the Hebrew National. Now, for some of you might think that I don't, Hebrew National, we might not eat it. But I'm not going to say it's not kosher, whatever. It's, but I'm there for those of you who would say it's not kosher, let's assume that. That was, well, actually, that wouldn't be a good example. You say it's of lesser kashrus, because in my mind, I knew for a fact this guy's not religious. He's going out and he's going to go to Burger King and get his fish sandwiches, or go to the fish restaurant and everything. He's not keeping kosher. So by giving him this, what am I supposed to do? I'm supposed to be firm on his account, saying, no, there's no kosher meat in America in any supermarket. So then he's going to eat real tarfus. So here I said, if there was Rabashkin or something, I would have pointed out the Rabashkin. There wasn't a Rabashkin, so I showed him the Hebrew National. And I have one of the relatives I have in a place where there's no kosher meat. So I suggested, I said, what do you need to get the hot dogs? You get a Hebrew National hot dog. Okay. Baruch Haim just says, no, it's not a question. This is not the machlokas. Does this person wanted to say that Rav Bamberger thought maybe for the let him sin a little by being part of the general community because you accomplish great things? And no, Rav Chaim Moser says no, because according to each one of them thinks they're doing the right things. And Hirsch's side thinks that by being with the general community, it's an isser, an actual, it's forbidden. And according to the Bamberger side, they see this as not, they don't see it as a sin. Adrav, mitzvah hu, zakos. They think it's a mitzvah to bring Yiddishkeit to the general community, and they think that the Mafritim, the separatists, are doing an Avera Gedola. No, sorry, no, and that which the separatists think, see, as an Avera, they see as a big mitzvah. Philosophical fees that be Mitzvah Avera. So the question is being in the general community a mitzvah or an Avera? The Hirshhayim side says it's a mitzvah. The other side says it's avera. The other side says it's a mitzvah. By the way, the description of Chaim Ozer here is not Bamberger. Bamberger never said it's a mitzvah to be in the general community. He said it, you have the option if you want. He did say that there could be some advantages that come out of it. You can make sure you can then influence them. But he never said you there's a mitzvah to. He said there could be some advantages if you don't want to. His grandson, it's Rav Una. He adopts the approach we spoke about in the last class, the Achdus approach. That's actually a positive thing. It's a mitzvah that these people today are Tinuk Shenishba, and if we're together with them in one community, we are helping them, and therefore it's a positive thing. So Rav Chaim Ozer gives a perfect description of what in his day, in 1913, were the two sides. I think it's the same description today. The modern Orthodox who are involved in all these community-wide organizations will say they're doing a mitzvah. And the other side will say, no, it's just the opposite. And then he concludes again by repeating that in when you deal with this type of machlokes, you can't find sources in the Talmud. It's only higayon yashar. You just have to use clear logic, and only local rabbis can decide it. And he says, not all the Medinos and the Zmanim are Shavim, different places. And he says, you know, you can't want just what the rule in Poland is not going to be the same in Germany and Lithuania, all this. He says, if the Gedolei Hador of the previous generation did not involve himself in this, which is an almost correct statement. We saw that the Maharam Shik did involve himself, but it is a fact. Rav Yitzchak Chanan Spector never dealt with this, and all the other Rabboni you mentioned, they didn't get involved. They said, this is the dispute in Germany. It's not for us to get involved with. He says, how can I, Seir Ba'afei Yisrael, how can I give a ruling, Lagid Davar Barachok Makom, far away? He says, okay, so then he goes on. And then he says, the general question you asked, he said that this, the changes in the reform movement, it doesn't mean anything. They haven't, Lochit Shubazak Kofrim Davar, they've made a few changes, but the fundamental point that the reformers are heretics and their ideology is heresy, this is the same, he says, since it's the Broad Frontline Conference. This has been since the beginning of reform. Nothing's really changed, you know. Whether they say now, let's say you don't need a get, and it doesn't matter. At the end of the day, I don't know what the details were. The point is, it's all in small areas, but the fundamental point of reform is the same thing. And then he says, last paragraph. Lo shel davar, lo matzasi l'fisha hishtanus b'nogel matzav kilosam. I haven't found any changes. And on the general question, I can't answer it. And he says, if I could give you a halachic answer, I wouldn't cover it up because lo saguru, he says, I'm not afraid. I give you my answer, but I don't have what to answer you for the reasons he said. And therefore he concludes that it remains as it is. If anyone's going to change it, it's not going to be me for all the reasons we saw. So I wonder though, how you see your genius, Rav Chaim Ozer. We have a rabbinic expression, just like you get schar on drisha, you know, on something you do, also something you abstain from doing, you can get schar on drisha. Here we see Rav Chaim Ozer given a chance to issue a ruling for an entire country, Germany. You know, they're giving him that authority that he's going to issue such a ruling. He's asked by someone, he chooses not to. I don't know, how often do we see this today? It seems that all sorts of questions are asked by the Gedolim in Eretz Yisrael, and the truth is they don't understand the situation in America at all. We have plenty of qualified local rabbanim who can answer these questions, and yet how often do the rabbis in Eretz Yisrael say, you know, I'm not there, you have qualified rabbanim, local rabbis who know the situation, they should answer it. Sometimes they do, but often they don't. And often you hear about rulings issued from rabbanim, faraway places, about local communities. This has been one of the problems with the breakdown of the old system. I guess it was inevitable because modern communications, but even the local rav needs to know anytime he gives an answer, someone could then call up or get an answer from some big rav in Eretz Yisrael that upshugs the local rav, and that creates problems. But when you, as you go through life, listen, pay attention to how many times these psukim that affect our communities come from rabbanim far away who really have no knowledge. Even if some rabbi in America goes and explains it to them, they don't really understand our communities. I mean, if we didn't have poskim, if we didn't have reliable poskim, okay, then what choice do you have? But we do have. Every city in America with any substantial Jewish community has not just one, but a number of reputable, reliable posting that you can rely on. You can take it to the bank. So, well, all of a sudden now everything has to go to Israel to find for rabbis who don't know the situation. So it's disappointing. And I think that we see Rav Chaim Lozer's greatness that he understood that some questions are not just, first of all, you need to be on the scene. And second of all, the idea he's acknowledging that there are shailas that are not just halacha. Fundamentally, they're hashkafa. And he says that these are, it all depends on your hashkafa. And they both are right, depending on their hashkafa. So I love this letter. I think it's really amazing. Now, this dispute, as I said before, Auschwitz, non-Auschwitz, with the majority of the Jews being in the general community, including almost all the East European Jews, when they moved, they joined the general community because in Eastern Europe, every single community was full of irreligious and religious. Now, some have tried to make a distinction that, wait a second, in Vilna, yes, it's true that you had the irreligious, but it wasn't reform. You know what? I don't see the difference. What's the difference? A secular Zionist? How do they differ from Reform? They're all heretics. They all are unopposed to Torah Judaism, and yet the philosophy, and we saw the Netziv actually justify, well, I'll get into it later. They explain, the Netziv and others, that in Eastern Europe, we don't believe in separatism. We believe in being together. We fight among ourselves. But we're still one community. They had this sense of community. So it made sense that when East European Jews came, they joined the general community, just as they were in general communities in Poland and Lithuania. Well, later I'll talk about the Netziv's famous response about this. But this dispute remained in Germany until the end. I wanted to give you an example of how this played out in the 1930s during the Shlita controversy. The Nazis had banned Shlita without prior stunning. Shlita of cows with chickens. There was another. You had to like break the neck right after Shlita, which is wasn't such a problem. The heter for that was simple, easy. But it's amazing when you read the literature that they needed beef. Why do they need beef so much today? If we were told we couldn't have beef, we could live on chicken. I could live on chicken. I go to a steakhouse and I order a chicken. I'm very happy with chicken. And you know what? Now we're told beef isn't so important, but it was in those days, they thought beef was vital, especially for the older people. And when the Nazis banned it, the fear was in fact, it wasn't just a fear, the old age homes, the communities were pressing that the old age homes, which were under hashgacha, were going to start feeding. That you couldn't have shlita without stunning animals. So the community leaders told the rabbanim that if you don't find a heter, we're going to start feeding in the old age home non-kosher meat because the old people need meat. Not to mention the fact that you had lots of Jews who were, let's call them the non-observant Orthodox, who would buy kosher meat if it was available. But if it wasn't available, they're not going to give up meat. And therefore, they were going to buy non-kosher meat. So here you have a question. What's your achrayus? What's your responsibility? Do you feel a responsibility for the entire community, and that would lead you to look for a heter, a permission to stun animals before shlita, or is your approach going to be we're not going to change the way we shecht because of people whose commitment to halacha is not absolute? It's a big problem, we can understand this position, I think. I mean, why take liberties with the halacha for the people who are not committed? But when Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg was approached, and not just him, the other non-separatist rabbis, they felt a sense of responsibility. And Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg investigated the matter and came up with what he thought was an acceptable heter, permission to stun animals before Shlita. Rav Chaim Ozer prevailed on him not to publish it, and therefore he didn't, but he always thought he was correct in this. And in a few places like Sweden and Denmark, they did stun animals before Shchita. Is this l'chatchila? Absolutely not. Is this permissible under normal circumstances? No. But Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg thought that this was an emergency situation, and his fear was that what about all the people who are not so committed to halacha? And he was willing to cut corners and to rely on a heter, which halakhically he thought had basis, but obviously it's a radical thing going against what we've been doing for so long. It opens up the door for the change of Shlita in other countries as well. But he thought that we have a responsibility to do what we can, at least if we can rely on some heter, even if it's we're really stretching our necks out here trying to find anything to lean on. But if we can find some basis to spare the masses of Jews from eating treif, that's our responsibility. The response of the Hirshians in their community, their rabbi, Rabbi Horowitz, was absolutely not. They refused even to engage with Rabbi Chaya Weinberg with his heter and to discuss halachically. The first line of Sridi Yesh is the back and forth of the different post scheme in response to Rabbi Weinberg's proposed heter. The separatist rabbis refused to engage at all. Their attitude is like, we're not even going there. We're not even going to try to find a heter. What we're supposed to find a heter for people whose commitment to halacha is not absolute. We're not going to lower our religious standards for them. So here you, and therefore we'd give up. We won't have any meat, and we won't. We don't need meat. We can live on chicken or no beef or no vegetarian. So the separatist community, their primary loyalty was to themselves and to upholding halacha the way it should be. Rabbi Weinberg had a more of a Klal Yisrael approach. There's no right. There's no wrong answer. I mean, we have this issue with our day schools. There's day schools, the more right-wing day schools, many of them, that they won't accept you if you're not religious enough for them. Some of them, if you have a TV in your house, they won't accept you. And I understand that because they don't want their children influenced negatively, and they're focused on their community. On the other hand, I went to a school from Rabbi Teitz, and his attitude was that every Jewish child should have a Torah education. And it didn't matter, what your background is, and everyone was accepted. I had people in my class who were completely from complete Machal Shabbos families. In fact, there's one person who, if I mention the name, there'd be people listening to us now would know him because he's a rabbi, but came from a I knew his family, completely a religious family. And Rabbi Teitz's attitude was that that's, and I grew up with this. We knew that certain people's house we went to, we couldn't eat at their house, things like that. I don't think there's any right or wrong. It's just a different approach. Do you have a broader approach, or are you focused more internally? And I mean, there's more to speak about that. I see the time has already come to an end. What I want to do a bit more about this controversy in Germany, and then I just want to talk about what happened in Hungary. For those who signed up already for the summer trip, this is going to be good preparation. Because we're going to deal with this a lot when we're in Hungary. And then just carried through to America. How did Auschwitz fare in America? And the whole dispute between community and separatism. So maybe two more classes, let's say, on that. And then we'll return to Rabbi Bamberger for maybe two more classes just about more aspects of his life and interesting halachic positions. So I want to now take some of the comments and questions. Oh, and I'll get, God willing, I'll get next class. Again, all about what I found out about the name Bear, with the origin of it, and a refutation for the suggestion that it comes from Yisachar, and you don't want to call a person Chamor, so instead you give him the name Bear. So if you paid attention to the Torah reading this week, you'll know what I'm referring to. So we'll get to that next class. Carla says, yes, paternal grandmother's family name was Bear. It'd be interesting. I assume the family name and the Shem Chol, that is the first name that people were known by, would have the same origin. Wait till you hear some of the theories of where this name Bear comes from. It's not so clear. Yes, Jules.
I have a family tree of the bear side of my family going back to the 17th century in Germany
In
and
Frankfurt.
in Frankfurt am Main, I think. And it was the sign that happened in Germany a lot. Sign of the store they were running was a bear for some reason.
Ah, that's interesting. Well, you'll have bear. The people are named Bear. If you go to the Prague Cemetery, for instance, you'll see a bear on the tombstone. They would put that on. But I'll give you the details next week. It does seem pretty clear that it's not that the name was Dove and then they gave the name Bear. It's that the
No,
name was
no.
Bear and then it became Dove. It worked backwards. But
Yeah.
I'll provide the evidence hopefully next class. R says that your mother passed away 2 days before Shavuos, was buried in Israel 2 days after Shavuos during COVID. You were told to begin singing Shiva on Erev Shavuos when the body was taken to the airport. Yes, that's what Rav Moshe holds. There were those, as I said, who would want to argue that today, if you're watching it on Zoom, what's the difference? It's not like they wanted. They explained that when you would bring the body, let's say, to the carriage that would take it away, you wouldn't know when it was be buried. So they're makel that you should start sitting shiv immediately. But remember, the lashon of the Shulchan Aruch is you don't know when the burial is going to be. So it makes sense that you would say, well, if you do know when it's going to be, then you'd wait to the kavura. But Rav Moshe disagrees. He says that that's not how, despite the lashon of the Shulchan Aruch, that's not how you should read it. And that's the majority opinion. That we do it that way. Although, I mean, in theory, someone could make the argument that today we're on Zoom, we know when it's happening. Why the Shulchan Aruch's ruling shouldn't apply today, but the Halacha Maaseh doesn't. Nissan says Rav Tuvia Goldstein considered the Maharsham to be the Posek Achron. The Maharsham, Shamash Vadron, Brezhin, he was regarded by so they use that term of the Posek Acharon about him. A number of people use that. He wasn't accepted by everyone. He was a big mekil. The Minchas HaOzer was very opposed to him. And I think in the Darchei Tshuva from his father also, he goes off against him. And but he's a great gaon, the Maharsham. Susanna says, since there's multiple opinions, it could be left to the bereaved to decide. I think that's a good answer. But the thing is that that's if someone knows there's two opinions. But if they ask the rabbi, then the rabbi has to decide. I don't know. I guess what a rabbi would do is they'd ask the rabbi would ask his rebbe what the practice is. But if you're in a small town and you get the question, it's not so simple in those days. Today it's easy. You call up without cell phones. What do you open up the Greenwald and it gives you two options here. You have the Nitziv and you have the Maharsham. So whatever you do, you're right. Rabbi Rakefet likes to say about Yom Tov Sheni in Israel, whatever you do, you're right. Because if you hold one day, 2 days, you have big authorities on either side of it. Ellie says that the Hildesheimer Seminary was groundbreaking. They reestablished it a few years ago, and my son-in-law was a graduate of the second year of its reestablishment. Yes, I know this seminary very well. In fact, on the two groups I took to Germany, we stopped doing that because people, not enough people want to go to Germany, but the 2 years we were there, we actually had lunch at this community. It's called the Adas Yisrael, and they reestablished the Hildesheimer Seminary. Of course, as we mentioned in the past, it's a very different Germany today. Most of the population is German, is Russian. So it's not like they insist on getting a doctorate. It's not, it's a continuation of the seminary, but it's a completely different, community, so a different perspective. Now, the Adas community, it wanted to be recognized by the government as the historical continuation. I don't know whether it was, that is, to get any monies or anything. There's another community in East Berlin that also claims to be the Adas. They have an institution called the Adas, the shul there. They too wanted to be recognized, and they lost. And they were not, a guy named Offenberg runs it. They lost in the court. I don't know, this is Rabbi, Josh Spinner runs it. So I was supposed to, before COVID, remember I've shown you in the past, I paid for a Stolperstein, the gold on the ground, the bronze, whatever it is, for Rabbi Chaim Weinberg in front of where he lived. And there was supposed to be a whole, dedication with the Hildesheimer Seminary and the Adas community. It was supposed to be in June of 2020. It had to be canceled because of COVID. I have not seen it yet. I hope, I want to take my son, I think, in June to go there and see it. But yes, it was groundbreaking. Abba says it's not up to the bereaved to decide. If they ask or give an answer, they follow that psak. Yes, but I think Susanna was saying if you know there's two, like if I would have opened up, now I don't know. I asked the Shilas about my wife, this her situation. But let's say I opened it up and I saw that there's two opinions. And I mean, if you see there's, let's say, the Nitziv and the Maharsham. Are you obligated to ask your local Orthodox rabbi so he can give you a psak? I don't think so. I think in a case like that, because what's the local Orthodox rabbi going to do? He also is going to be stuck with the same problem. I could be wrong, but I think in a case like that, you're within. It's like if you have an issue, do you light Hanukkah candles before Havdalah or after Havdalah? So you look it up and you see the Chai Adam says one thing and Mishnah Berurah says another. I mean, does it really, does it matter one way, really make a difference which way you do it? I don't know. Dov says, if you recall correctly, David Ellingson was invited and appears in the famous bio video of the Ruff to sing his praises. You know, I saw that video and I don't remember, but he would be a perfect person if you want to get from the other side, from the non-Orthodox. Whitepants says that Hirsch writes, it's a pity the Chasam Sofer is no longer alive because then they would have gone to him and everyone would have abided by his psak. And based upon what the Chasam Sofer wrote, he would have agreed with Hirsch. He says in I think it's the very last tshuva in Tshuvas Chasam Sofer in volume 6, he says if we had the authority from the government, we would put all the reformers in Cheirem. That's what he says. So it's hard to see how he would not have agreed. Oh, there's one more thing I want to do about the Auschwitz, though. We have to get to the Eretz Yisrael, though, because Rav Kook, he has an ideological opposition to Hirsch, and Rav Bamberger becomes his hero. We'll get to that. Paul says that a cousin of his in London is embroiled in a fierce argument with a shul rabbi who has just ushered the use of tea bags in the shul kiddush after about 80 years of use in one of the least traditional shuls in the United Synagogue. Okay, well, here you have an interesting question because on the one hand, you hire a rav and you have to respect the rav and you have to give kavod to the rav. But if the rav gives a decision which is so out of line with, forget just Rav Moshe and Shmir Shabbos Kol Chasa and every other halachic sefer pretty much that I know of. It's, by the way, the Rav held that klisheni. He said, my grandfather knew halacha and he held you could do it in a klisheni. If you're gonna, I don't know what you mean, he ushered use of tea bags completely. That is probably, if he did that, it's probably because he's worried. It's a gezeira. He saw people who probably were not putting it in a klishishi. And therefore, he wants to create a gezeira, like a decree to try to stop people from sinning. But what are you going to do? Can we make our own decrees and think how that's going to backlash? Because then people will be, it creates a lot of problems. People get very annoyed and upset. So I don't know. But what you say, Paul, is interesting because it's a situation that Hirsch found himself in. He issued a psak and the people didn't listen. But that's different. If the rabbi issues a psak and it's in the shul, even if you don't agree with that, I think you sort of need to follow it. You can get rid of the rabbi if you want. Next time his contract comes up, you can fire him. But as long as he's the rabbi and he's issued a psak, when you're at home, you can do what you want. But when you're in the shul, or if the rabbi declares that you can't use cans on Shabbos or something like that, which is a more mainstream position, I think you have to listen to the rabbi. If you're not going to, you give him the authority. The problem is when the rabbi gets involved in things that are not halacha. Sometimes the rabbis try to, like, let's say the rabbi were to give a decision that no one can daven for the omud unless he's wearing a jacket and a hat. Like, let's say the rabbi just declares that in a modern Orthodox shul. You know, that's not really halacha. So I don't know. Does the rabbi have the authority for that? That's a different thing. Paul says kosher meat for UK visitor. Note that all London-based and shlita is not glatt. Listen, people go to Israel, it's not glatt, most people, unless you're eating Mehadrin. You go throughout Europe, it's not glatt. People don't realize in America. They call us up about the trips and they say, you know, is it glatt kosher? It's kosher. It's 100% absolutely kosher. I can't say that every place we go to is glatt kosher, but in America, it's not glatt kosher. If you understand glatt, glatt in America just means of a higher standard. It doesn't mean that it like Beis Yosef glatt. I don't think any of us are really eat only glatt kosher. We eat reliable kosher. Today, it seems that the meat today, the reliable meat, happens to be what they call glatt. But if the OU were to start putting out, I was putting Ashkacha now on Hebrew National, I don't think, even though it's been like 40 years since we've been only eating quote glatt, I think we'd all eat the Hebrew National because we want reliable kashrus. We don't believe in glatt. We're Ashkenazim. That's what I think. Robot taxis. Okay, good question. Autonomous cars. That's maybe we should have him speak, Rabbi Kelman, one day. Rabbi Dror Fixler from Israel. He's an expert in this. Paul says that the London based and the new restaurants use glatt meat. Okay, so they can, you know, then what is glatt? Glatt is, I assume, the American standard. It's not Beis Yosef where there's no, They accept what's called arrears, which is it's like a little bit of adhesions. They claim that in Hungary that was considered glot, but not in Lithuania. In Lithuania, glot, there wasn't glot in Lithuania. When the rabbis came to America, there wasn't glot. The Rav gave hashgacha, it wasn't glot. There wasn't glot in America. All the gedolim in America ate regular meat because that's what the Ramah, that's Pesach of the Ramah. So we're Marachmir today, very nice. But I don't think the issue with Hebrew National is because it's not glot. I think the issue with Hebrew National is because people don't trust our Rabag. If the OU was giving Ashkacha, then it would be accepted. Sima privately texts me that it troubles him that Reb Chaim Ozer ostered Reb Meir Hildesheim from establishing a rabbinical seminary in Israel. Yeah, I discussed this in chapter 5 of my book on Rabbi Weinberg. You could say, well, how is he deciding based on he's not in the land of Israel? But he didn't just decide on his own. Rav Kook agreed with him. All the Rabbanim agreed that you couldn't, well, I shouldn't say that. Rav Kook said you could have it in Tel Aviv, but all the other Rabbanim basically agreed that you shouldn't have the, they didn't want the rabbinical seminary there. I happen to think it's a mistake, as did Rabbi Weinberg. It could have changed orthodoxy in the state of Israel, but that's Rav Chaim Ozer was he was channeling the view of the community in Eretz Yisrael that is the traditional community. Yes, you say, Ellie, you're right. The other Adas is an empty shell. In fact, the person who started it, Offenberg, he has some yichus with the pre-war Adas community, but he himself was. He has a sordid past. He was involved with the East German communists. I mean, it's not a good story. I don't know all the details, but it's for good reason. It's not accepted. Yes, the Adas Yisrael, as you say, Ellie, is integrated with the Lauder Foundation. It has a yeshiva there. It has a community. We went there for lunch, and looking out the window, you have a nursery school there, and you have like 15 little children running around speaking German. Whoever would have thought we would have seen this? And it's a wonderful, wonderful place. The Molotov cocktail that was thrown about a month and a half ago at a institution in Berlin, it was this institution, the Adas Yisrael in West Berlin. Okay, Nissan says, which memorial volume was tonight's letter published? It was published in the memorial volume for Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, which, as I said, is fitting because if you recall, Rabbi Weinberg, when he was asked this question, he said, I can't answer it either. He said, only a future historian will be able to look back and decide which approach, the Bamberger approach or the Hirsch approach, was better. And look, all the historians who are going to deal with this are themselves going to be compromised because they're going to have their own hashkafic tendencies. They're probably all going to decide in accordance with their own inclination. If you read the writings of people from the Einheitsgemeinde, they always come out on Bamberger's side. And if you read the writings from the Ausschussgemeinde community, they always come out on the other side. So what can we do? Rabbi Kelman isn't here, and I don't know what future classes are coming up, so I'll just say I thank the Sulzbachs again for sponsoring it. Thank you all for coming out tonight on this new year, and look forward to seeing you all, God willing, next week. And if anyone is interested, not just the people live, people, many more listen on YouTube and on the tapes, on joining our Central Europe trip. There's going to be a Spain trip also that's going to be advertised. But right now, the Central Europe trip, there's a nice early bird discount. Check it out. We really have an amazing experience, those who've been with us, and a chance to really see where, so much about Ashkenazic Jewry in Central Europe, beginning in Budapest and ending in Prague. What an amazing place, Prague. So let's leave it for all tonight, and thank you all. See you next week, God willing. Good night, everyone.
Thanks.